terrorists declare war on the United States.
Military officials here at the Pentagon are confirming that seven are dead. At
least. Armored vehicle stands guard.
Downtown New York in chaos.
The 7.0 quake was centered roughly 10 miles from the capital city.
We want the public to feel safe.
Thousands likely dead.
The world seems so unstable, so insecure. Everything is changing way too fast. But there are some things that are steadfast. Things that never change, God and His Word. Join Pastor Randy Reams as he shares truths from God's unchanging Word.
Joshua chapter 18, reading verses 1 through 7. We will basically cover the entire chapter, but we'll read these verses because that's where I want to emphasize actually a verse, particular verse in here and one of the further parts. So Joshua chapter 18, verses 1 through 7. Then the whole congregation of the sons of Israel assembled themselves at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them. And there remained among the sons of Israel seven tribes who had not divided their inheritance. So Joshua said to the sons of Israel, "How long will you put off entering to take possession of the land which the Lord your God, your fathers, has given you? Provide for yourselves three men from each tribe that I may send them, that they may rise and walk through the land and write a description of it according to their inheritance, that they shall return to me. And they shall divide it into seven portions. Judah shall stay in its territory to the south." We talked about that before. "The house of Joseph shall stay in their territory to the north. You shall describe the land in seven divisions and bring the description to me, and I will cast lots for you here before the Lord your God. For the Levites have no portion among you." This, by the way, all these chapters say that many times. "Because the priesthood of the Lord is their inheritance. Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh also have received their inheritance eastward beyond the Jordan, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them. You may be seated." And some of you may ask, how do you get a sermon out of that? Well, then you haven't known me very long. We were on the way back traveling back, and generally the weather was good, but I don't know how we got started, but Courtney and I started talking about, well, maybe I did, I don't know, about some theological things and God things. And so, I don't know, half hour maybe, we talked about things. And then Judah speaks up from the back. "Dad's gone too long without preaching." Because they were getting a sermon in the car. And that's just the way I am. So go ahead and hit the next one. I think we got there. There you go. And I'm sorry for the way we have to do this. But they stop here now in Shiloh. And you could see Shiloh's in Ephraim, and my laser pointer would work, but it's not working. Remember, down here is Jordan and or Jericho and Gilgal. And so they've gone considerably distance north to Shiloh, where now the division of the land's going to sort of take place for the other tribes that have not done that yet. Okay? And we know that according to Deuteronomy, God said that you're going to put the tabernacle in this place that he will choose. That's in Deuteronomy 12:11. So by implication, since Joshua takes it there and sets it up, we assume that God told him to put there because God says, "I'm going to show you where," and that's where he puts it. Okay, I don't think that's a difficult thing. So next slide, I think. Yeah, here you go. I think this is from BibleWalks.com. I want to give credit. But, man, that's a little more blurry. I don't know if it's the adjustment on here or what. There we go. Okay, so it's actually not the highest point. Right over here where the picture is being taken from the east, is what's called the city of Shiloh. It's basically an Israeli settlement, okay, and they built houses over this way. And so I point out to the left there, there's a Byzantine church, because we'll talk about that. And there's these new excavations there where they're finding out all kinds of things just recently in 2013-14. And the summit, but you can see where they think the tabernacle might be placed. I'll show you another site that they think, which I think fits better than that one. But you can tell it's not actually on the summit, where because there's no room on the summit based upon the description of the size of the tabernacle, which we've talked about before. Okay? So we really know that this is one of the places in the Bible they're pretty certain of. Because over in Judges, it tells us sort of more specific that it's north of Bethel. It's east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem. It's south of another city in the hill country of Ephraim. And because the Roman historian Eusebius and Nestorius talk very particularly about where this is located, okay, in the 200s and 300s AD, all right? And so American philanthropist, actually, he sponsored an expedition, was on it in 1838 and reestablished this. And some of the things we find, for example, is a Byzantine church. Well, when we find these churches, whether it's the Church of the Nativity, right, or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre back over there, we were established a long time ago. Why did they choose that spot? And that gives us some clues to start thinking along that line, okay? So next slide, please. One of the things that they find is a Middle Bronze Age, this is before Israel shows up, a wall that's left there, and this hill is sloping. There's a fancy archaeological name for that. But that made the people have to run uphill to even attack it. But this wall, they found to be, I've got it on here somewhere, 24 feet high. They can tell where its high point is. And at its width, 18 feet wide. They believe because of some statues and things that they found from that Canaanite era that perhaps they use this as a place of pagan worship as well, okay? So it's 100, that spot, that peak at least, is 131 feet above the rest of the area around it. But what's interesting, in the late Bronze Age, I don't, if you want to know, 1550 BC to 1200 BC, Egypt conquers most of what we know now as Canaan. And so the Canaanite people's dominance in Shiloh pretty goes pretty well unimportant, mostly uninhabited during that period of time. But some people think what put an end to Egypt's extent out into Canaan was the Israelites leaving Egypt. Somewhere around 1400 BC is the numbers they guess at, and I'm not going to go into all the details. So as the Egyptian influence wanes, that's when Israel is walking into the promised land here. And then when we get to the early Iron Age, and I think that's the next one. Go to the next slide. Yeah. And that's part of the interior. They've put a roof over it because the roof's long gone. It was wooden. A Byzantine church there, and it's a pretty cool-looking old Byzantine church that's there. And so that Byzantine is basically the Middle Ages type period of time. But at the early Iron Age, which is before this, the early Iron Age, they actually find this is a time when Israel would have been actually inhabited. The time of Samuel, the time that Hannah goes and prays at Shiloh at the tabernacle, that period of time. They find a whole bunch of inner courtrooms, I guess, around this area. 25 huge, I don't know what you call them. I don't really want to call them vases because they're sort of bigger than that. Containers of oil and wine. They find wheat, things like that. And what's interesting is at the Battle of Ebenezer when Israel loses the Ark of the Covenant, remember that? The Philistines take it. Maybe you don't remember that. Okay, but during that time, they burn Shiloh. Well, they show a significant, matter of fact, 1 meter thick of destruction level, of burnt level there at Shiloh, along with the wheat was actually carbonized as it was burnt in some of the containers, okay? And so during this Byzantine time, they also, there's a villa that's been built. So if you go online and looked at Shiloh, most of the archaeological stuff you see is from a Byzantine era. And what's interesting, I think there's a mosque on the next one. Yes, this is called the Mosque of the Orphans. They don't know why. Okay, built in the Middle Ages, because in case you don't remember the Crusades, Israel, what we call Israel today, changed hands between the Muslims and the Crusaders different times. Well, underneath here, they have found two more Byzantine churches. So some reason, both Islam, which are those who say they're of the lineage and they may be of Abraham, they built there, the Byzantines built there. We begin to ask why. That's when these guys a long time ago start digging there and stuff, and they begin to do that, okay? So the next one, I think, is the slide of possible. Now, this is below the mountain. This is in a flat spot. And what they find is a wall that they're not sure how high, but up off the ground, but not a full height wall set in this area, and it fits the dimensions of the tabernacle. But you and I both know the tabernacle didn't have rock walls. They had curtains, right? Well, when we read in the Mishnah, which is traditions of the Jewish people, and they write those, okay, in the second century AD, when they write about these things, it says when they were at Shiloh, okay, they had a stone wall below and cloth above. So those who hold this view, that this is where it's at, think this wall was there. And then above that, they had curtains, so sort of like wainscot in stone for the tabernacle. And it does fit the dimensions for the tabernacle. And you could see they're excavating that even in recent times, okay? So the word Shiloh is associated with the word shalom, which means peace. So it has some meaning of tranquility, but that tranquility is based in the idea, because the base word means he whose it is, or let me put it another way, that which belongs to him. That gives you peace and tranquility, because you belong to him. Israel belonged to God. That brings peace. So over time, the etymology of the word is the word shalom grows out of that. That's what Brown, Driver, and Briggs' Hebrew lexicon tells me. Okay? Now, here's interesting, though. If we go back to Genesis, chapter 49 and verse 10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples till Shiloh comes. So many say that, of course, we believe that has a messianic implications. And so one of the things that is, okay, so let's assume that word meaning tranquility or peace. Okay. Now I want you to take yourself to a Roman emperor, Caesar Augustus. Is he in the Bible? Yes, he is. He's the one that gives a decree for there to be a tax, right, and a census. The purpose of the census is a tax. The Bible says a sentence. The purpose is for a tax, all right? That all the world, the then known Roman world, and that's why they had to go to, Joseph and Mary had to go to Bethlehem. He also declares in 27 BC, so 27 years before Christ about, he declares Pax Romana. Did anybody take history at all? Can you remember that far back? Means Roman peace. Peace in the Roman world. So when Shiloh, when peace comes, it is during this period of time that Rome appoints a governor over Israel, and the Sanhedrin no longer rules that region or the Jewish people. So even the Jews believe that this point, the scepter, the rulership of Judah leaves Israel during the time of Roman peace. I find it interesting that the Prince of Peace comes to the earth during the time where peace is declared in the known world, the known biblical world. So they go to Shiloh, they set up the tabernacle, and here there's been a bit of a controversy about who gets what land. There's a whole bunch of us. Why do we get the same size as this group over here? There's not as many of them, okay? And these five other tribes, Levi has to, we'll say four, Levi doesn't get an inheritance. It gets cities within each one, have already been given to them. Remember we talked about Caleb, which is the tribe of Judah. God promised that he can have his pick because what he and Joshua did, there were those guys that said, let us have our inheritance on the eastern side. So all that's already taken place. We did that in the previous chapters. That leaves seven tribes, Benjamin, Simeon, Zebulun, Issachar, Asher, Naphtali, and Dan, now to get their land. So Joshua basically sends three guys from each of those tribes, that's 21, to basically map, survey, and divide up the land. So they divide it up. There's no bias here. There's three guys from each group, and they go out and survey and divide up the land. And then Joshua, this is how it determines. Now imagine this. I like this land. We three guys from the tribe of like this particular spot. And so as we're mapping it out, you know, this is the one we're going to pick, right? The problem is, that ain't how it happens. What does cast lots mean? Let's roll the dice. If it's a six, Dan gets it. All right, if that's my way of doing it. Okay, if it's a seven, Neftali gets this piece. Okay? Wow, that seems an awful odd way to determine God's purpose and plan, doesn't it? It does to me. But we find out, if you remember the story of Achan, remember he took the stuff from Jericho? You know how they determined it was Achan's plan? One by one, they went in front of Joshua and he cast lots. Joshua chapter. And the lot happened to land correctly on, just happened by chance, to land on the guilty party. Okay, we seen the same kind of idea in the Urim and the Thummim. Remember we sort of talked about they put it in the priest's breastplate? Okay, so you had, should I do this, God? And he sort of rolled the stones. They weren't necessarily dice. And one meant yes and one meant no, basically. Okay, wait a minute. God gives a direct command to Israel. This is how you determine God's will. Go to Vegas. I want you to think about that a minute. That seems very strange to us, and I understand that. But you have to understand, Proverbs 16:33 says this, the lot is cast into the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. In other words, he says this, I control how the dice land. Wait a minute. Especially, you know, as Christians, we tend to, you know, no gambling type of thinking, okay? Before I go any further, I want to take a little side trail. I want you to understand, chance does not create and has no causing force. Watch. Chance and time created all there is. Problem is, chance isn't a thing. It has no substance. Chance is a way we use basically to describe possibility. Or probability, okay? What's the likelihood of the dice coming up snake eyes? And Las Vegas makes a lot of money on that probability. Mathematically, they figured that out because there's only so many sides to a die, okay? So when we say chance, chance isn't a thing that can create anything. So you have time and nothing. Basically, I'm going to tell you, go read Stephen Hawking, the great physicist of our modern times. You guys may know he's the guy, and I can't remember, they just made a movie about him, but what disease led him to where he's in a wheelchair and he moves his head or his chin or something, and it makes a computer speak for him. Do you guys know who I'm talking about? What was the name of the movie recently? Anybody know? Okay, they make him out to be a hero, whatever, but he does have a brilliant mind. But he'll tell you, time and chance created everything there is. There was nothing, and then gravity created, well, first of all, if there's nothing, there's no gravity. But they think, for some reason, they talk about probability, a chance having some creative power, some causative power. Well, chance doesn't have the power to do anything. Robert Kuffall, if I say it that right, and Kelly Seagrave wrote in 1975, the creative creation explanation, a scientific alternative to evolution, page 99 through 100. Also, P.S. Moorhead and M.M. Kaplan wrote an article on the Wistar Institute Symposium Monograph Number 5, in case you wanted to know, you want to write that down, Mathematical Challenges to Neo-Darwinism Interpretation of Evolution. I'm giving credit where credit is due. The probability of the smallest that we know of living organism to evolve by, quote, chance and time. 1 to 10 to the 340 millionth. That's a 10 with 340 million zeros behind it. You would never go to Vegas if you had those kind of odds. Vegas wouldn't exist if it had that kind of odds. Okay? And if I remember the numbers rightly, science itself says anything out of 10 to the 16th is impossible. Wait a minute. They say that's impossible. Or is it 10 to the 32nd? It doesn't matter. 10 to the 340 millionth? That's a whole lot of chance. So I want you to understand, we look at these games of chance, the rolling of the die as chance, a probability. What's the odds of it landing on Achan? How many families were there in Israel? Not tribes. Each tribe went before it, and each family in that tribe. So I'm not sure. There's probably a number that gives you the possibility, the probability of that happening. But here, God tells them to do this by lot. But we learn that this is one thing that Joshua said. Look, you're not doing this on your own. God's got to force it on you. What he says in verse 3, how long will you put off entering to take possession of the land? Remember what we talked about. Israel generally now controls the land, but each tribe had to go into their portion and conquer the bad guys. I'm tired of fighting. I don't want to go to my land. We'll just hang out here. Okay? It's like the 34-year-old that won't leave home. Okay? Living in your basement kind of thing. They don't want to leave. And God said, I'm going to force you then. We're going to divvy up the land and you got to take your portion. You can't live here. This is going to be mine. Joshua says, that's where Shiloh is. I think he's tribe of Ephraim. Joshua says, this is where I'm at. Y'all got to go. Okay? It's time to move out. And he's going to force this on. God has a plan for each one of those tribes. That brings me to this. The doctrine of God's providence. Now, if you read our founding fathers, they use the word a lot. A lot. And those in modern history today, or historians today want to tell you, it just refers to deism. Problem is, what's deism? There's a God who wound up the clock and let it run hands off. That you can't be a deist and believe in providence. Providence means God's hands on. And thus the name of the place, Providence, Rhode Island. You know, they believed it at least, okay? So let me, according to Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology, page 316, this definition of the first part of providence is called preservation. I think that's pretty easy. God keeps all created things existing and maintaining the properties with which he created them. All right? By the way, I read 480 pages of that while I was gone. I'm about halfway through. If you want to read it, I recommend it. Okay? But here's the idea that water has certain properties that make it water and not gold, not a fish, that makes it water. So God created the water. We can see that in Genesis. But he sustains, maintains the things that make it water. For the, y'all know what the weak force and the strong force is in the nucleus? All right? Because opposites attract, positives repel, why in the world doesn't the nucleus come apart? Something holds it together. They don't know what it is. They can sort of mathematically explain the relationship, all right? But there's something there that holds the atom together, both the nucleus and the electrons. Something holds them together. The properties by which an atom functions, God maintains so it stays an atom. That's preservation. You got it? The idea of it? Okay. Nehemiah 9:6. I have a lot of scriptures today, okay, and they're not going to be up there. So you have to write them down if you want them. Isaiah 9:6. You are the Lord. You alone. You are God alone. Oh, it's okay. Just forgive me if I'm not on key. Okay. You made heaven and the heaven of heavens. That means up in heaven too. With all their host, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them. You preserve all of them. And the host of heaven worships you. Notice that this is a reason for worship. That God preserves, maintains all the things that he created. Okay? Job 34, 14 through 15. And I give you a scripture because there's great consternation about the doctrine of providence, and so I give you scripture for it. If he should set his heart to it and gather to himself his breath, it's your breath in our lungs. So we give, okay. All flesh would perish altogether, and man would return to dust. Now imagine, we've all seen the movies before scuba, and when you went down in the big iron thing on your head, you know, and somebody was upstairs pumping the hose to get you oxygen. Okay, that's God. It's his breath in our lungs. He's pumping. If he ever stops pumping, you're dead. It's your breath in our lungs, so I'll pour out. Yeah. You better be nice to the guy upstairs pumping that oxygen when you're down there in the diving bell. See, we forget that. We take for granted breath. But God says if he just holds back his breath, his spirit, all humanity would cease to be. Oh. God, if you never did anything for me, I'm breathing, right? Then I could praise you. Hebrews 1 and 3, speaking about Christ, who is the exact representation of the, okay, upholds all things by the power of his word, which is his breath. There you go. Okay, Colossians, you heard me read it to the kids. 1:16 through 7, for by him all things were created. Notice his sustaining, his maintaining is connected with his creation. Both the heavens and the earth, the visible, the invisible, the thrones or dominions, rulers and authorities. I hate to tell you, God made Trump and the title and position he'll hold, and Obama as well. All things have been created through him and for him. Did you catch that? He created it for him, not for you. For him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together or consist. Without him, it all falls apart. The universe collapses.
This is Pastor Randy Reams of Kindred Bible Church in Nampa, Idaho. I want to thank you for joining us today for Truth from God's Unchanging Word. This broadcast is an outreach ministry of Kindred Bible Church. I'd like to invite you also to visit our website, kindredbible.org. There you can listen to today's broadcast as well as previous broadcasts. If you're being ministered to by the broadcast, I'd like to encourage you to let us know. You can email us at info@kindredbible.org, or you can write to us at Kindred Bible Church, P.O. Box 32, Nampa, Idaho, 83653. And I'd like you also to check us out on Facebook. Look at us over there and give us a like. So again, I want to thank you for listening to Truths from God's Unchanging Word.